Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Today I'm talking with Gary Lipman, who's written a book for people with short attention spans. So you might guess from that they're short stories. Take that a step further and think one-sentence stories. How is that even possible? Well, much more on that later. When we spoke, Gary was out here in the Pacific Northwest on his way to see his friend and well-known Northwest author Tom Robbins. So I thought it fitting to read a quote that's on the back of Gary's book. It's written by Tom Robbins, who says, "Gary Lipman's book, titled Alone, feeds a reader with 23 times more intrigue than most of the recent novels in a big city bookstore combined. Just wait until you pilot your brain boat into these uncharted literary waters." So a little bit about Gary. He was born and raised in New Jersey. He received a law degree from Northwestern University and has worked with New York's Innocence Project. His play Paradox Lust ran in 2001 off Broadway, and his writing has been published in the New York Times, the Paris Review, Vice, and many more places. The book is called We Love the World But Could Not Stay, and here's my guest, Gary Lipman. Gary Lipman, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you here, and thank you for joining us. And I know this is your second book, We Loved the World But Could Not Stay. But you have such an interesting background, Gary. I want to just share a little bit of that with our listeners, since we haven't talked before. And I read that you were a lawyer. You practiced with New York's Innocence Project for a while. And then you started writing, like many lawyers, right? But
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the transition from law to writing fiction, which was your first book.
That's an excellent question, though. In my case, unlike a lot of lawyers who become writers, I was writing from the beginning. And even before law school, I was writing diligently. I wasn't publishing, but I was really identifying as a writer and really passionate about writing. And I went to law school to kind of earn a living, or that was the plan, because I was fascinated with criminal law. So that was the motive with law school. But even throughout law school and practicing law, I was writing.
Mm.
The ironic thing, though, is I haven't, in either of my two books, though there are crime elements in them, I haven't really drawn on my legal work for my fiction.
Right, right. And
yeah.
So your first book was fiction. This is your second book is a collection of short stories. Tell us just a little bit about the first book you wrote.
The first book was, I guess you might call it crime fiction. It was dark comedy, a Hollywood novel. It was set in Los Angeles, and it's about a quirky story about a guy who's a writer also, but unlike me, he's got a particular obsession. He's obsessed beyond all reason with the murdered movie actress Sharon Tate, who was the tragic young pregnant victim of the serial killer Charles Manson.
Right.
Back in the late 60s. And of course, she was featured prominently in the Quentin Tarantino movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I had this idea about a guy who was obsessed with a movie actress, and I came up with the idea of it being Sharon Tate, because that seemed like a real doomed obsession, because the person you're obsessed with is already no longer with us. And in thinking about it, I thought, well, what would be a good story to go with a character like that? And I thought, got it. He's obsessed with Sharon Tate, and he falls and gets very involved with a woman who's equally obsessed, but with a different famous person, Charles Manson. So
yes.
It's a very bad match, and they kind of, in their doomed affair, recapitulate the the Charles Manson catastrophe. So that's a Hollywood novel, and a fairly pretty long one, about 400 pages. So for my new book, after that, I decided I wanted to write short things. I didn't want to write a novel. I wanted to write short stories, and I'd always been attracted to really short fiction, you know, like from few words or a sentence to a few pages. And I thought, you know, as a unifying thing, what could I do to kind of have each story be a certain length? And I came up with the idea of each story be one sentence.
Yes, that's what I did. I love the way that Lorraine Bracco blurbs it on your book. She calls you the amuse-bouche of storytellers, which is a perfect description of your stories.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
And
I'm very pleased with that.
Yes, of course. And so for people who are thinking, okay, it's a one-sentence story, so I'm expecting, you know, one, two, maybe three lines. Some of these one-sentence stories run on for almost a page, one for almost five pages. So you take some grammatical liberties there, as they they might say. Tell us
you
about...
would say, you, being polite, say liberties. Others would say commit linguistic crime.
It's such a subjective thing, though, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you there's not only a tradition for very, very short fiction, including one-sentence stories. I'm not the first to invent the idea. But, you know, there's a book of stories where each story is 100 words long, or where it could be multiple sentences, but 100 words, no more, no less. Then there are stories that are, you know, famously, Hemingway had the very six-word story.
Yes.
Apparently, Hemingway did not write this, as has been, you know, said. But the six-word story that is attributed to Hemingway, I think, is a heartbreaker. And it, do you know it, Vicki?
I can't remember what it is. No.
Yeah, I'll
tell
us. Remember it. It's only six words. So the story goes, for sale. Baby shoes, never used.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that is powerful, right?
Yeah, and I thought when I first encountered that, you know, you're not getting a whole story there, you're just getting the hint of a story, but it's enough of a hint to give you a little aesthetic satisfaction.
Yeah, and it sparks the imagination, which I think good storytelling should do. We shouldn't be told everything. It should engage us and our imagination, too. I've heard you say that roughly one-third of the stories are autobiographical, approximately a third are entirely invented, and the other third are a blend of the two. But you're not going to tell us which ones, right?
Oh, of course. Only my wife knows for sure.
I read that you liked writing the most, the blended kind, where you tossed in certain true life experiences. And why were those your favorite to write?
I think probably because you surprise yourself. You know, in the process of writing these, you know, unlike my novel or other long stories I've written, short stories or essays, I published a lot of essays, journalistic essays online. You know, you have an outline, you follow the pattern, and you may come up with cool ideas, but you're, you know, kind of following through, even with the novel. You know, you have an idea of where you're going. Maybe you surprise yourself with the novel where a character behaves other than you expected, and you think, that's cool, let me follow that. But with these short stories, because they were so short, you know, and sometimes they're, as you say, a whole page, more than a whole page, but mainly they were pretty short, so there's not a lot of room to go, you know. Well, there's a lot of room in the sense that you could write anything you want, but with one sentence, you kind of have to, you can't run around in a lot of different directions. You have to kind of hit a mark.
Right.
But what is the mark? Very often, I would take an autobiographical experience, something I personally had happened to me or that I did, or that I heard about a friend or a family member doing, and I would write it up, and often that was a good one-sentence story. I'd change a few details. But sometimes, and here's the surprise of it, as I was getting into it, I would have a spark of an idea and think, ah, and it would become an entirely different thing than it started out as.
Yeah.
And so, and I would surprise myself. And in a novel, when you have those surprises, they're relatively minor unless it's a big major revelation about, oh, I have to end the novel this way, not that way, you know?
Right.
But I didn't find with writing the novel that there were that many big revelations, whereas with many of these stories, I'd start out, as I say, with a true life experience and then think, well, what happens next? Is it good enough? And then I'd have an idea of taking it in a totally different invented direction. And to me, that surprise that came from that idea was why those were the most satisfying of all.
Yeah, makes sense. I picked out some of my favorites, Gary. I'm going to ask you about those in just a moment, but I wanted to just take a look at the title of the book, We Loved the World But Could Not Stay. Tell us where that came from.
Well, I'd heard that that's an old saying. It's actually maybe a Native American saying, which was, we loved the earth, but could not stay.
Mm.
And I always thought that had a haunting tone to it, that saying. I later heard it was on the tombstone of a science writer named Lauren Isley. And so it's been around. Nobody, to my knowledge, has used it as a title. And I just thought we love the world rather than the earth had a better resonance for my book and what it was about. And a lot of the stories, there's something like 300 plus stories in the book, so it was hard to think of a title that could sum them up. I toyed with the idea of one that seemed too silly ultimately, which was Too Much Pork for Just One Fork. I like that, but it seemed too silly because, as you know, in the book, a lot of the stories are pretty sad and dark,
yeah.
And a lot are very funny and silly, but I thought that this title, We Love the World But Could Not Stay, had a kind of elegiac, sad kind of feeling. Also, I have a character in one of my stories, one of the longer ones. I mentioned that she's working on a book that is entitled We Love the World and Plan to Stay.
Hmm. Yeah.
So I thought that the title sort of answered that.
Yeah.
As inevitably it would have to.
I love the title. I mean, I think I like the other one too, but I do think that's more humorous, as you said. But this does conjure up all kinds of imaginings to me.
Thank you. Yeah, I think titles are really important.
Yes, I agree.
I'm glad you agree. Yeah, I remember there was a book when I was a kid that was called The Man. And I remember even though I was like 8 or 9, I thought, that's not a cool title. You know, give me The Great Gatsby or Huckleberry Finn, you know, The Man.
Right.
You may be wondering who's the man, but it's not very flavorful.
Right.
It
doesn't, draw you in.
I might add that even though I have all these stories for most of them, even though they're only one sentence, I decided to give each one a title. And I had a lot of fun coming up with titles for them.
Yes, well, I want to dive into a couple of those stories now. So the first one I chose is Nose Deep. And I love this story because I have allergies and I love to camp. And I'm also always afraid of running into a mountain lion while we're camping. Tell us a little bit about that story, if you would, and what inspired it.
Nose Deep, as I recall, that's, I can't
it's
find it.
On page 45.
That's the lion, right?
Yeah, and there's a lion outside, and it starts, the camper sneezes, and the lion growls because...
Exactly. Well, that, you'll be glad to know, Vicky, is an entirely true story. nothing made up about that. My wife and I had the great pleasure of volunteering twice at an orphanage in Tanzania in Africa. As teachers, we volunteered. A wonderful place. It's not actually an orphanage because the kids there, while they're orphans, they're not up for adoption. So they live there. That's their home, and they're extremely well treated and taken care of and educated. And so it was a fantastic experience for me and my wife to do that. After working there 1 year, we took a little safari in Tanzania, and we were on the shores of a lake, and we were in a tent and at the lake, and it was a nice tent, but you know, you're definitely out in the middle of the wild. And we were told that lions occasionally will walk up to the tent, but don't worry, they won't come into your tent. You know, what was more worrisome is they said there will be snakes in the tent sometimes. Mm. So if you see a snake, they said don't move, and poisonous snakes, you know, venomous snakes. So they said, in fact, they said that often the snake will be at the bottom of the toilet bowl. So you have to look before you sit down.
Yes. No getting up in the middle of the night in the dark for that.
Yeah, exactly. That's where your flashlight comes in handy.
Right.
Where you just, yeah, so I nervous about the snake and in general not, you know, feeling I'm not in the proverbial Kansas anymore there. My wife's a much more brave person than I am, so she wasn't bothered by any of it, but I, in the middle of the night, woke up, and I had a terrible allergy attack, and was sneezing, and then I noticed there was a growling right outside our tent, which I recognize as kind of guttural growling, kind of unique sounding, that we'd heard, you know, tapes of lions, so I recognized it was a lion, and it was so close, it was just beyond the canvas, you know, wall of the tent. And so I thought, oh, no, man, I hope, you know, they promised us they don't come in tents. They don't like to be in confined spaces. But it was just annoyed by something. It kept growling, and I kept sneezing and blowing my nose and sniffing. And it suddenly dawned on me that my sniffing and sneezing and snuffling were annoying the lion. It was that which was pissing it off, you
right,
know,
right.
And angering it, you know, or making it afraid and making it need to display dominance, you know. And I thought, well, I wish I could stop sneezing. And then it dawned on me, I have an allergy to a very severe allergy to cats. And it dawned on me suddenly that the lion's presence, a lion being a cat, of course, big cat, was causing my allergy attack.
Mm. Yeah.
And the lion, and my allergy attack in turn was annoying the lion and
right.
keeping it there. So I realized we were locked in this, as I put it in the story, dysfunctional relationship.
It's quite a dilemma there, quite a dilemma. Another one that I liked, and this is, I'm guessing this is true because it has your name in the title, but it's a funny story. It's also quite profound because it makes you realize something about yourself. And that's who put the Benzedrine in Gary Lipman's Ovaltine.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, that's a story that uses what I call the smush technique, where I put two things together, two kind of unusual things pushed together. That's the story. Again, I don't have it in front of me. That's the one about my birthday party, right?
Yeah, then the porn actress at the Tribeca dinner party
exactly,
shows you a
right.
video.
So,
yeah.
So, yeah, there is that's a perfect example of a mix of autobiographical and invented. And putting the two together in this case was using what I say the smush technique, where you take these disparate elements, like, for example, with the TV show The Sopranos, you've got a guy who goes to therapy to solve his family problems, and a guy who has a mob family that he's running, and they happen to be the same guy. So you smush those two worlds and situations together, and that tension between the two creates a cool TV show. In my case, I had the experience of being at a dinner in Tribeca in New York, where I live in Manhattan, and I met a porn actress, a fairly well-known one, and we got talking. We knew somebody in common, and the owner of the restaurant introduced us. She and her date, who was also a male porn actor, they joined our table. We had a big group there, and we were talking to them. I haven't hung out with a lot of porn actors, but it was interesting, and they were friendly. And so at one point, she showed me on her phone a video of a new line of sex dolls that had been made in her likeness, which, you know, I'm, as a writer, I'm interested in anything stories people tell me, but this was really intense, you know, and bizarre. And in this video she showed me, all of these sex dolls that were made to look, you know, exactly like her anatomically, her body, also her face, her hair, they were all hanging on hooks in a warehouse or in a showroom.
Right.
And she was, in the video, she was, looking up at all these sex toys, sex dolls that look just like her. And I thought that was such a bizarre thing.
Yeah, really?
Then I separately had the idea of a birthday party where everybody who comes is you, yourself, at a younger age. So everybody there, is you. It's like, you know, the Vicky your age now, Vicky at 13, Vicky at, you know, 6, Vicky, you know, everybody
right. Your
age and younger at your birthday party. Right. And so I thought that would be a bizarre situation, and I wrote up a story about it with a kind of twist at the end. And then when I thought about, when I was writing it, I remembered that porn actress and the sex dolls that she showed me that all looked like her, and so I combined the two in one story, and that was pleasurable to put the two together in that smoosh form that
right.
I like.
Right. And do you have a favorite story, Gary, or are these all your babies?
I definitely, there's one or two that are little, they're all my babies, but there are definitely some I like better than others. And for example, I like the, I mainly like the ones where I invented new endings for real situations. So I do lean toward those, as we said earlier, but I have one favorite by far, which is a kind of poignant one for me. It's a story toward the very end of the book, and it's the longest story. It's multiple pages.
Mm-hmm.
So I set it up in a way that I think it's pretty readable. It's a story with a strange title. The title is The Last Living Pictish Speaker on the Planet.
Right.
And that story is the kind of backstory of that is my mother, I was very close with my mother, and she was a single mother, and I'm an only child. So my entire first 18 years, I was raised just by a single mom, just the two of us. And so it was a very intense relationship. Tragically, she died when I was 18. She died young. She was only 49. And she also had a very unhappy life. Unhappy before she met me, unhappy, you know, in general. She was fundamentally an unhappy person. So I had the idea of writing a story about a woman who starts out from the same background as my mother did, but who goes on to have a really long and happy and fulfilled life. So this story, which is my favorite, is the story of a woman very different from my mother, but who kind of gets to live the life that my mother didn't get to live.
Hmm.
And it's my favorite, I should add, not just because of that emotional context, but also because it's my favorite writing in the book. It was the most fun to write because I really give this character, this woman, a crazy life, you know, a lot of crazy experiences. So that was the most fun one to write as well, hence my favorite.
Right, right. Well, thank you for that. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the writing of the book. Are you okay to read Goodbye, My Book to us?
Sure. Yeah, this is the second to last story in the book. It's where I sort of give my explanation for why I wrote these one-sentence stories, and the story goes like this. I write stories that are only one sentence long. I explain to you as I plant this book like a time bomb in your public library, because imperfection is easier to tolerate in small doses.
I love that. I love that. But I also know as a copywriter that to write well and write in short paragraphs like this is hard work.
Yeah, it is. But in a way, you know, it's very fun. It's really cool. My wife had to stop me from going on and on, even after the book was about to be published. I just kept writing one-sentence stories, even though I knew I didn't want to publish a second book, at least not right away. You know, it was so much fun to write these, but it was a challenge. It's a different kind of writing,
yes,
as you know.
Yes, but that to me is the thrill of it, to take this chunk of words and just see what you can knock out and make it tighter. And I'm guessing that's what you really learned from this whole experience with over 300 stories, is how to write really tight.
Yeah. Every once in a while, I allowed myself a liberty of a detail or a slight, you know, parenthetical digression, just to give a little flavor for the story and just to kind of say, you know, yeah, I'm going to break this rule here a little bit, you know. I was influenced, you asked about the really long stories, and in those I was influenced, I should add, by the great writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who wrote, of course, the great novel 100 Years of Solitude.
Mm-hmm.
His novel that he followed up, 100 Years of Solitude, was a book called The Autumn of the Patriarch. And I was reading that at the very beginning of the time when I was writing these one-sentence stories. And each chapter in that book is like 20 pages long and only one sentence.
Wow.
So each chapter was like a 20-page long single sentence. So I knew I didn't want to do that. And those were crazy. Talk about breaking grammatical rules.
Right.
I mean, it was just complete run-on crazy. But it did, you know, make me want to break some rules myself and write some longer sentences.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did. And there's certainly a variety of stories here. And just going back to the one you just read to us, Goodbye, My Book, the last line there is, because imperfection is easier to tolerate in small doses. How do you deal as a writer with all the usual writerly anxieties like self-doubt and fear of rejection? Or do you even have them at this stage?
I'm glad you asked me that, Vicky, because if you look in the dictionary under self-doubt, you'll find as an example, a sterling example in all of humankind, my picture. Self-doubt, anxiety, you know, is it good enough, perfectionism, all of that. I've been there since the beginning. I'm still there. But one thing I learned, which I think is why I was finally able to send the book to the publisher and say, hey, you want to publish this, is because I just learned life is short and you got to just, if you want to write, you're never going to be perfect. You're never going to be as good as your favorite writers, or even a lot of writers you don't think are that good. You just have to do your best and then get it out there. You know, you reach a point where you think, I've done pretty much my best. I know if I look at it a month from now, I want to change a lot. But there comes a time where you just have to say, I'm done with this. I've done pretty much the best I can do. I've really tried hard. And now it's time to send it out. And maybe the publisher or the agent will give you suggestions, and then you take or leave those, and you improve it, and you'll be rewriting it in the galleys for the publisher, so you'll get another shot at it. But you can't just sit with something forever. You have to send it out and move on.
Yeah, I love it. Love it.
And, you know, have the courage of being rejected.
Yes.
One of the best things is my novel got rejected by plenty of agents and then publishers, and, you know, and it just, the more you get rejected, the going, and this is how it is. And it just takes one person to say yes.
That's right. That's right. It has to land on the right desk at the right time. That's what I always say.
Yeah,
great advice there, Gary. And I want to talk a little bit about creativity, because you're a journalist, fiction author, this book of short stories, you're a playwright also, and you have quite a body of work as a visual artist. So tell us about some of the things that inspire and influence and stimulate you as an artist, as a writer.
Well, the visual art, I mainly do, I do photography, but I mainly do collage, and of my own photographs and also found images and mixing the two. And I've been doing that for a long time, not quite as long as I've been writing, but I began doing that actually when I was in law school as a kind of break from the legal studies, which could be interesting but really dry and associated with a lot of anxiety. Talk about self-doubt and anxiety. There was a lot of that going around in law school. That's not limited to artists and writers.
No.
So, yeah, of course. So while I was in law school, I began doing collage, which I really enjoyed because I guess in a way it's nonverbal, you know, with the law and with writing, you're dealing with language and having things make sense or not make sense, or make a kind of sense. Whereas with the collage, which are often pretty, you know, surreal or kind of kooky, mine at least, I could kind of evade having to make sense or evade having to make language mean something, you know. Occasionally I would use words in the collage, you know, and then initially I would give them titles, but then I stopped. It was just fun to work with the visual images and not have to make them mean something logically, the way law and even writing often required.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Yeah, so it was a break from thinking that way, thinking in a different way.
Yeah, and it helps you see things in a different way, I think, when you practice different forms of creativity.
Well, I wish I had other art forms. A good friend of mine is a very accomplished actor. He's a writer. He's published a novel. He's a musician with a band and a screenwriter. And an incredibly multi-talented person, and really good at everything he does. And I envy, I'm not a musician really. I play a little guitar, but I'm not good enough to call myself a musician. And, you know, I have to imagine that if I were able to be a musician, that would just add another way of seeing and being creative, of course, and approaching creativity.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we just need one person to believe in us. And in the acknowledgements, you thank many people, and you write a beautiful thank you to your uncle, Dr. William Fearn. You say, if I owe my sanity, indeed my existence, to a single person, that would be him. Tell us how he shaped your life and what it might have been like without him.
I'm so glad you mentioned him, because, and this follows from what I said before. My uncle, who's now 92 and like a father to me, he is the brother, the only sibling of my mother, who I mentioned earlier died young.
Right.
And when she died young, I was an 18-year-old who was a pretty sheltered, I was worldly in some ways, but I was pretty sheltered in others. And he became like he wasn't a mother or a father exactly, but he became a mentor, a protector, a teacher, a guide, a spirit guide. He really was the great parental figure of my life after my mother died. And I owe him everything. I had a tough childhood, and I once met a well-known therapist, Esther Perel. I don't know if you've heard of Esther Perel.
No.
She's written a lot of books, and she said, I told her about some of the challenges of my childhood, and that my mother then died when I was 18. And she looked at me. She was very insightful. She said, "Who saved you?" I said, "Well, actually, someone did save me. It was my uncle, my mother's brother, who became like a great parental figure for me." And she nodded her head and said, "Uh-huh." And I said, "How did you know?" And she said, "Because when somebody's had a really tough childhood, but they're okay as an adult, they're stable, somebody helped them. Somebody older took the time and the care to help see them through."
Mm.
And that's what my uncle did for me, and I thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, I'm greatly in his debt.
Yeah, I could tell that was written, from the heart. It was beautiful acknowledgement there. Well, Gary, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, GaryLipmanOfficial.com, and Lipman has two P's, GaryLipmanOfficial.com. The new book out is We Loved the World But Could Not Stay. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Gary?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Vicki. You've been a wonderful interviewer, and it's been a great conversation. I should just add one more thing. Every writer benefits from showing their work to other people. And whether it's a friend or, a teacher, whoever it is, you can't write alone. You need to show it to someone. You don't need to, do everything they say. Oh, and it has to be someone who cares about you and wants you to succeed. Who isn't going to, kiss your keister and just make you feel good and say, "Oh, this is great, everything's great." You want somebody to give you an honest response to what you've written, but you want them to be on your side and not competing with you or dismissive. So I hope every writer out there has somebody they could show it to, even if it's not such a close friend, but somebody they trust. In my case, it was my wife, who I also owe a great debt to. She was the first reader for everything, and a lot of things she didn't like, and said, "Go back, write it again."
Yeah.
"But not this one. This one has really not going to make it." So that's the last closing thing. I hope every writer out there who's listening can have somebody, look at their work and give them an honest opinion, but a supportive opinion. And ultimately, I hope everybody can finish their stuff, even if it's not perfect. Get rid of the self-doubt and take it to the limit.
Love it. Thank you, Gary Lipman. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.